Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for being here. I know it's the last PSYOPs session slot of the conference before the closing. I appreciate you coming. I'm really excited about this session. We're sitting here, most of us 1,000 or more miles away from our home, right, on our smartphones. I think that's a very in-our-face reminder of how much technology has changed just in the past few years. And what we wanted to do in this session is talk about changes in technology and how they can be applied to I.O. And we have two different speakers who are, I think, going to represent one more so the science and the other more so the practice, but I think there's some science and practice in both of their talks as well. So I think I'll go ahead then and introduce our first speaker, who is Ben Waber. He's joining us from Sociometric Solutions, where he serves as the president and CEO. He'll be discussing the use of their technology during his talk. He and his colleagues' research has been featured in a variety of media outlets, such as Wired, NPR, and The New York Times. His research was also selected for the Harvard Business Review's list of breakthrough ideas and the Technology Review's top 10 emerging technologies. So we've got a breakthrough idea for our breakthrough talk. He is also currently a visiting scholar at the MIT Media Lab, which is where he received his PhD in Media Arts and Sciences. The list keeps going. He recently published a book called People Analytics, which is a fascinating read. If you're interested in what he talks about today, I highly recommend it. And he just told me it just got translated to Japanese, right? Yeah. And this is his first time at PSYOPs, so let's please give him a warm welcome.
You know, thank you, everybody, for just avoiding the lure of the beach for at least a few more hours. So, what I'm going to talk about today is some of the research that I've done and some of the work that we do at my company, Sociometric Solutions, which is fundamentally about using data, in particular behavioral data, to understand how people interact and collaborate at work. And I actually want to start out with a question here. Just you can think to yourself. Or you can shout out if the mood takes you. How many people do you think you spoke to today? Anyone want to share? I've probably only spoken to four or five people today, I think. 20? Okay. Now, how confident are you in that answer? Scale of 1 to 10, what do you think? Kristen, I'm going to pick on you. Yeah. 6. Okay. Anyone else? Anyone feeling more confident than 6? That's right. Most people are shaking their heads. Okay. So you'd be right to shake your head, first of all. People are only about 30% accurate if I ask you how many people you spoke to today. Right. Now, that's really important because when we think about the type of data we normally collect, when we want to learn about how we're working, about how we're talking to people, typically we ask them. People are not wired to remember stuff like that. People are not wired to remember what they did every day. We're all familiar with all the biases that we typically are subject to, but there really hasn't been a way to get better data around that. Now, the reason I'm interested in better data is because using behavioral data to change organizations is something that we've seen some success with in a number of very specific industries. And I'm going to talk about one in a second, and that industry is baseball. Okay, for 150 years, the way you built a baseball team is you had a bunch of old guys who knew a lot about baseball, watch people play baseball, and then based on their subjective evaluations, they would build a team. And sometimes they were right and sometimes they were wrong, but that was viewed as the best way to do things. Keep doing that into 2001, and then you get this guy, Billy Bean, or Brad Pitt, if you like, who said, no, you know what we're going to do? We're going to use data about behavior to build our organization. Now, in the case of baseball, obviously, this is hitting and fielding, but fundamentally, it was data about behavior, and everybody thought he was crazy. And now we know what happened. They went on a record winning streak, and now every single organization, every single baseball team, build their team in this way. The question is, could we do the same sort of thing for business? Is the lack of data that we have in management really impacting the way we do things? And I think that when you take this perspective, you can see why a question like this might be troubling. Why is organizational change hard? Might actually seem like a weird question. Things like mergers and acquisitions, things like restructuring, they're just hard. But as a society, we do an awful lot of very hard things. What's interesting about things like M&A is we spend about $2 trillion a year on M&A activity. It fails approximately 60% of the time. I mean, that rate really hasn't changed over time. We waste about $1.2 trillion a year doing that, which is crazy. And you could say that, you know what, we know this is hard, and we're just going to resign ourselves to throwing $1 trillion in the wood chipper every year. Or you could see that maybe we're looking at the wrong metrics. The metrics that we typically look at when we try to do stuff like M&A and restructuring, we look at the stuff over here. Right? We look at the org chart. We look at formal processes. Because this is very easy to quantify. I can point to that guy at the top, and I can say that's the most important person in the organization. But let's ask a different question. Let's ask, who is the social center of your organization? How is information flowing across a company? It's very difficult to answer. Traditionally, the way we get at that is I'll either ask people in a survey or I'll send out human observers to watch people at work. We know the problems with those. I mean, surveys, again, if it's a beautiful day out like it is today, you answer differently than if it's a cloudy day out. We're, as I illustrated at the beginning, pretty inaccurate at even remembering how many people we talk to, much less who we talk to. And then on top of that, if I try to get human observers to follow people around, you know, maybe I can do that if I want to follow 20 people around, 30 people around. What if I have 100,000 employees? How could I measure that? Well, now we have the tools to be able to do that. We're carrying around with us every day a variety of sensors that are actually measuring what we're doing in the real world. From your cell phone, from your company ID badge. Company ID badges are actually a very sophisticated sensor. You know, the little RFID chip used to tap into doors? If I put little RFID readers in the ceiling, I could figure out where you are. Of course, besides being a little creepy, that doesn't actually tell me how you're interacting. How are you communicating with other people? What are you doing? What we've done is we've added a number of additional sensors to these ID badges that enable us to capture that data. To show you what we can measure, I want us to go through a regular day at work. Let's think, so maybe people get into work, and at first you have a little meeting, then you go at your desk and you bang out a few emails, then maybe you have coffee with a colleague. But what you're doing is you're not just having those conversations. What you're doing is you're actually generating data. When you're in a meeting, you're actually generating information on how dominant you are. I can measure what percentage of the time you talk. And as probably a lot of you are aware, if we're trying to come up with new ideas, if we're trying to make a decision, if one person speaks 80% of the time and no one else speaks more than 3% of the time, we're not going to come up with very good ideas. Well, let me rephrase that. You know, if I speak 80% of the time, we are going to come up with very good ideas. But for everybody else, you know, we want it to be more balanced. Right? You don't just have to look at how much people are speaking, though. I can look at the flow of the conversation. Who talks after who? Is it I talk and then you talk, and then I talk and then you talk, and then I talk and then you talk? Again, conversation will be flowing through me. We're going to come up with my ideas. I'm making the decision. And there's been decades of research showing that this is a pretty ineffective way of holding a meeting, of making decisions, but this is still the way it happens. Well, now we can actually measure this. And I can also look at not just how long you speak for, right? Did you speak 60% of the time? I can look at for each turn you take. You know, do you talk for 1 minute, little 1 minute segments, or do you talk for 10 minutes? Do you go off on a rant? Again, those indicate things very different about the type of conversation we're having. Even when you're by yourself, you're generating a lot of data. Just for example, I can look at your posture and I can see, are you leaning into a computer? Are you leaning in to, when we're having a conversation, does my posture start to mirror yours? That indicates very high levels of empathy. It indicates that I'm actually engaged in what I'm doing. I can also look at how much I move around. Am I very active? Am I very energetic? Which, of course, is important for health purposes. Also, turns out it's important for things like creativity and job satisfaction. And finally, when you're by yourself, you're generating an awful lot of digital data about what's going on. From email data, I can see who's emailing who. I can see how often they email each other. I can see how information is flowing. Same thing with IM data, phone call data, calendar data. And this data is already there, right? I can press a button and I can mine all this. And I would argue that the value of that data is greater than the value of these tools as they're used for communication. When you're in a conversation with somebody, we're not even just looking at that, are you talking or not? I can actually look at how you talk. I can look at your tone of voice. Tone of voice is very interesting. Typically, it's very difficult for us to change our tone of voice. You know, if I tell you that you should speak 10% higher, most of us just get like a Mickey Mouse voice, and that's maybe not so effective. But it turns out we can use tone of voice for something else. We can actually use it to measure stress. I can use it to measure your cortisol levels. The way we came up with this is working with some researchers out of Cornell. We had 300 people wearing badges for 4 weeks at work. Every 15 minutes, I had those people spit into a tube. Okay, so thousands of vials of saliva. And the reason I did that is not just because I like saliva, but because the gold standard of stress measurement is cortisol, right? And I can get your cortisol level from your saliva. You send off those saliva samples to a lab, and you can get those levels. There have been work in the laboratory showing that your tone of voice is very predictive of stress. But we wanted to see, is that true in the real world? Turns out it is. Turns out from looking at changes in your tone of voice, we can predict 61% of the variance in your cortisol levels. Which means that now I can go into a company, and in the span of about 2 hours, I can tell you what are the most stressed teams in an organization. On top of that, I can look at things like how quickly you speak. I can look at your volume modulation. Are you talking like this and being very emotive? Or are you talking like this and using very flat affect? People can understand what this means. And actually, language doesn't really matter here. This is essentially like watching a foreign film, but turning off the subtitles. Computers don't know what you're talking about, but you can get the sense that this person doesn't like this person, these people are having a heated discussion. That's what we're measuring. And the reason we can measure this is that sensing technology has changed an awful lot in the past few decades. The group where I got my PhD, the Media Lab, actually used to be the wearable computing group. And back in the late 90s, we were making these big wearable sensing vests that had a big battery on the back that heated up a little bit too much. You know, but over time, we were able to figure out what are the sensors that you actually need to measure communication between people. And then we get to something the size of this. The sociometric badge, which can measure all those things that I was just talking about. Doesn't record what you say, we don't give individual data to companies, and we do this on an opt-in basis. But every, you know, within the span of 5 years, every single company ID badge is going to have these sensors. Okay? We actually have a new version coming out that's just the size of an RFID card. Hitachi has a smart badge, Motorola Solutions has a smart badge. This is just going to be in everything. Now the question is, what can you do with that data? What sort of things can you learn? Now what I'm going to do is going to take you through a few companies that we've worked with and published some papers on it to show you what you can do. The first one I'm going to talk about is in a large IT firm where people with master's degrees are configuring multi-million dollar server systems for their customers. These people are very interesting because even though these are white-collar guys that are working on these very expensive machines and physically configuring this hardware, they're paid based on throughput, based on how quickly they can turn these configurations around. They get a call from a salesperson who says, I need a machine that can do X, Y, and Z. They configure it, and those configurations can take anywhere from 5 minutes to 8 hours. Now, what we did is we put badges on these people, and we wanted to see what behaviors actually predict those outcomes. What was interesting is that when we just looked at behavior in general, by far the most predictive feature of your individual performance was how you talk to other people. It was actually the shape of your social network, who you talk to. The people who had a very tight-knit network, the people who they talk to talk a lot to each other, those people were much, much more productive than people who had a more dispersed network. But now let's get more specific. What this data enabled us to do is I could zoom in on the 5 minutes when you were working on a task, and I could see what did you do during those 5 minutes? Who did you talk to? How much did you move around? Now let's think about what happens when you're working on a task and you have a question. What do? Well, normally what you'll do is you'll talk to an expert. You'll talk to Al, right? Say, Al, I got a question. How do I fix this? And Al will tell you the answer. But of course, in a company, in any organization, there's not just one Al, there's multiple Al's. What was interesting is here, we were able to look at what does that network look like? Who do people talk to when they're working on a task? And we know it's work-related, because if you basically talk to somebody, right, for just personal reasons, when you're working on a task, you are making less money, right, just objectively. And what was interesting is when you look at this network, you see that there are four people at the center of this network that everybody eventually talks to. Right? Those are the Al's. I'm going to point out that everybody has the exact same job title. They're paid in the same way. And what was fascinating is that when you talk to Al, when you talk to those experts, you complete that task in about the third of the time that it normally takes you. Is a massive effect. That is worth millions of dollars to this organization. But those experts have average performance. They're middle of the road because they're spending so much of their time helping the people that they work with. And now I think this is a big problem, right? Because here, me and Al are getting paid the exact same amount of money, right? And worse, not just are we getting paid the same, but I could actually say, hey, well, you know, this Al guy, he's not doing that well. I could fire him. I could transfer him to another division. And I wouldn't understand that he's actually the whole reason that everyone else's performance is so high. So what we actually did here is we decided to implement a group bonus structure where everybody would get paid based on group performance. And this was great, and performance went up an awful lot. But I think it illustrates a point that I don't care very much about your individual performance. Right? We like to think that productivity is the amount of stuff that I produce. But if I spend 4 hours of my day making 20 people I work with 10% more effective, well, that should be my job. We just haven't been able to measure that before. Now, I'm going to skip over I'll quick go through this. You know, you might think that, you know, this IT firm, these people are doing white-collar work. It's very complex. What about a place like a call center? Now, call centers, they've managed pretty much one way for 50 years, which is that you're on a break, no one else on your team is on a break, and I only care about the amount of time you're on the phone. But we did some work with Bank of America where they thought something interesting was going on, because they have call centers all across the country with the same organizational structure, same employee demographics, very different performance. They thought it had something to do with the culture of these call centers, but they didn't know what it meant. We go in and we measure, and what we see is that people who, again, have these very tight-knit networks are much more productive. They're completing calls in half the time as people with the least cohesive network. So it was actually a straight-up linear relationship. And what was more interesting about that was that all of that interaction happened when people's lunch breaks would occasionally overlap by about 15 minutes. That's when 80% of that interaction happened. What we did is we said, all right, for half of the teams at Bank of America, let's give them breaks at the same time. So now everyone on a team of about 20 people has a break at the same time. We go back and we measure, and we say, after 3 months, what happened? How did behavior change? How did performance change? Where performance is a hard number. How long does it take you to complete calls? And this is what we found. Cohesion is measured by the badges. That's how much of the people you talk to each other. That went up by 18%, which you would expect. Now people have more opportunities to talk to each other. Stress went down very significantly, which, again, I can measure from changes in tone of voice. In this case, we also got survey data just to validate that. That went down by 19%, which also makes sense. Because now I'm on a break. If I had a tough call with a customer, you know, I can vent to the people I work with, and that'll help support you. Performance in the teams where we changed when they took breaks went up by 23%. That's a hard number, right? For Bank of America, that's worth about $15 million a year. Now, theoretically, there's a lot of reasons you would expect this. You're paid, again, based on your performance. You're given promotions based on how you compare to the people you work with. If I have a very tight relationship with the people I work with, I'm much more likely to share tips that I learn about how I talk to certain customers. Otherwise, if I share, you know, a tip with you, I'm going to look worse in comparison. Right? If it took me an hour to solve a problem with a customer, and now it takes you 5 minutes, well, that adversely impacts me. But if we're in a tight-knit group, then you know what? I'm going to give you that tip because I know it's going to come back to me. And if you don't share with us in the future, I'm just going to cut you out. So this was very impactful here. And we have a lot of nice case studies there. But this data can also do other things. The data that we've collected can also enable us to ask interesting questions just about the way we work in general. And one area that I'm particularly interested in is this area of remote work. Okay? And probably a lot of you are familiar with what these guys have been doing over the past year. So you might have seen Marissa Meyer in February of 2013 issued this order across Yahoo to say, you know what? Everybody's got to work from the office every single day. That's what we got to do. Right? We can't survive as a company if people are going to work from home. Now, and this had been her experience at Google. There'd been a lot of sort of subjective reasoning on her part that this was the right thing to do. And she got slammed in the media. People said this isn't fair to women. It's not fair to the employees in general. And I just don't like using anecdotes to trying to make large policy decisions. Right? So the question is, you know, can we look at the data here to see what's going on? Importantly, most of the people who work at Yahoo are programmers. And I don't know if any of you are programmers or have been programmers in the past. I think I come from a computer science background. I think the stereotypical view of a programmer is they're the person who sits in the corner drinking Mountain Dew and they don't talk to anybody, right? But I can tell you it couldn't be further from the truth. The code that you write depends on the code of hundreds of thousands of other people. And if you don't talk to those people, that's where the bugs pop up. So if you see things like these gaps here, if I'm person one and you're person two, and our code depends on each other and we don't talk to each other, it takes us 32% longer to complete that code. That's not just from work that we've done. There's work at Carnegie Mellon, other groups at MIT that have shown the same thing. Now, what we actually did is we wanted to examine this from a pretty objective perspective, and actually we did some work with IBM on this, where we mined data from hundreds of their developers, where some people were working in the same office and some were remote. And we just look at digital data. We didn't even handicap people who were remote. We just said, let's look at how they digitally communicate and let's mine out those dependencies from their development framework and let's see where the gaps are. And there's various ways we were able to associate a specific communication with a dependency. What we saw, though, was very interesting. And first of all, before I show you the results, we said if there was at least one communication about a dependency, then that was satisfied, then that was a congruency and not a gap. Okay, so it's essentially as conservative as we can possibly get. What we saw was that people who are co-located communicate on average about 55% of the time about dependencies. 45% of the time they don't. Those numbers were basically flipped if you worked remotely. If you worked remotely, about 45% of the time you communicate about dependencies, 55% of the time you don't. Now remember, all of that code takes 32% longer to complete, which means that Yahoo, by virtue of, when you back out the numbers, by virtue of getting everybody into their offices every day, saves about $150 million every year. Okay. Now imagine if Marissa Meyer had gone out and said, listen guys, we're going to save $150 million a year by doing this. Okay. Where we are as a company today, we can't afford to leave that on the table. The conversation would have been very different. She just didn't have the data to show that that was the case. But of course, again, I used the most conservative metric we could about communication. On average, it turns out that people who were remote communicate digitally on average about 7.8 times about a dependency. People who are co-located communicate on average 39 times about a dependency. We're not even getting into quality here. And interestingly enough, people who were remote in these groups actually had more dependencies with people working in other locations than people who were co-located. It wasn't that you had to work more with the people that you were close to in general. It was actually just the fact that you were in the same office had this kind of effect. Now lastly, the last thing I'm going to talk about is gender at work. And I'm really interested in this whole question because we've seen lots of books come out. We've seen Lean In. We've seen the nice essay by Anne-Marie Slaughter about how women can't have it all. They're all anecdotes, and I don't like anecdotes. Okay, so I'm vastly oversimplifying it, but I'm going to say that the Lean In hypothesis is that if women work differently, they would achieve different outcomes. Okay, and my question is, well, is that the case? Now, I hadn't really looked at gender before because you can't change gender, and so I'm not that interested in looking at it. But I want to look at the policy implications of what's going on. So we have lots of data from dozens of companies, and I wanted to just see, do men and women actually work differently? Now, we know there are differences in the way that men and women negotiate, and those can change differences in outcomes. That being said, I wanted to see if, do we talk to people differently? Do we have different kinds of networks? Do we move around differently? That's the first question. Do we work differently? How many people think that there is going to be a difference between how we work? Some people? I'm going to say about 60%. No. No difference. Every single company we looked at, there was no significant difference in any of the behaviors we looked at. We looked at a lot of behaviors. Okay? Networks aren't different. The way we talk isn't different. The way we move around isn't different. Okay, and those are the biggest predictors of outcomes when it comes to performance, to promotions, job satisfaction, all those things. And we looked at, just to give you a sample of the companies we looked at, pharmaceutical companies. We're looking at people, again, like executives in that organization, call centers, office furniture companies, sales organizations, pretty varied workplaces, and we saw the same thing. All right. What about behaviors that predict promotion? In a number of these companies, we had data that was longitudinal enough that we could actually predict if someone was going to get promoted at a mid-level of the company based on behavior pretty accurately. So we wondered, well, maybe it's just the behaviors that predict promotion that men and women differ on. Okay. So who thinks there's going to be a difference there? Who thinks that it's going to be different? Different? No. No. So essentially, men and women, when it comes to the behaviors that predict promotions, are also statistically identical. Interestingly enough, it turns out that women were technically 0.2% more likely to get promoted based on behavior, but it was not significant. And importantly, when you looked at the executives of the companies where we looked at, 83% of them were men. Okay. So all right, maybe there's one more thing we could look at. Because right now what we've said is, all right, there's all these different potentially behavioral differences that maybe lead to differences in how men and women are paid and how they're promoted. But there's one more thing that women definitely do that men can't do, and that's get pregnant, right? And so maybe there's some difference, because we're going to leave the egalitarian issues to the side, that men and women don't take the same amount of time off of work when they have a kid. Let's say women take maternity leave, and they take more maternity leave than men take paternity leave. Maybe that time off of work causes the difference. Now, unfortunately, I don't have enough data on maternity leave from the badges to actually say what that effect is. But there is this great study out of Stanford, I'm blanking on the name right now, where these researchers created fake resumes, and they changed whether or not the applicant was a man or woman, and whether they had kids or didn't have kids in the cover letter. Okay. And what they did is, first of all, they did a lab study to see how people evaluated them, what they would pay them, but then they also sent these resumes out for thousands of job openings, and they saw what percentage of people got callbacks. What was fascinating was that by far the most desirable candidates were men with kids. The reasoning was that those men, they're responsible, right? They're responsible for their kids. The next, single men and single women were actually statistically identical. And by far the least desirable candidates were women with kids, which means that we're discriminating against them. Again, and I'm not going to say that it's intentional, but we're talking about bias, right? And that sucks. Right? Because bias is very difficult to change. What's very alluring about things like the lean-in hypothesis is that I can just say, just by changing behavior, we just change a few things about how we behave, then in a couple years, everything's going to be fine. Bias is tough, because that's a generational thing. That takes decades to fix. Right? Now, you see really interesting ways to deal with this. This isn't just, part of it is, sure, companies can try to make women more visible and women leaders more visible, because they have them, and that'll help fix this problem. I mean, I can tell you, I have a 3-year-old, and if you look at the shows that he watches, about almost every leader on the show is a boy. There's always more boys than girls. And so you wonder, well, if you're exposed to that for 20 years, then all of a sudden you get into a company, are we supposed to flip a switch and then change that? I mean, we can't. I think you see interesting things like actually the Toys R Us branch in Sweden did a very interesting thing where they randomly assigned a boy or girl to play with a toy in their catalog, which meant you saw, girls playing with Nerf guns and boys playing with ironing boards. And it was funny because I heard people say, well, boys don't play with ironing boards. You were like, well, of course not. If that's the first thing you say when they do that, then that's not going to change these things. And that might seem like PC overreach that's really what we're doing. But fundamentally, if we want to change perceptions of what we think of when we think of leaders, then we're going to have to do a lot of those things. All right, and I just want to thank you very much for listening to me. And as Krista mentioned, I have a book. You should all pick up multiple copies. It makes a great gift. But thank you very much for listening.
Thank you, Ben. Really fascinating stuff. Next, we have one of our own PSYOP members, Kevin Impelman. He is a talent management consultant with IBM's Smarter Workforce Division. He said a quote earlier when we were talking, which I wanted to include. He said, being trained as an IO psychologist, he never thought he'd find himself in a software department at IBM, which is where he is now. So he has a unique perspective in terms of our training and then ending up working a lot with technology and how you can sort of leverage those two things. In his role, or he's very passionate about technology, particularly its use in assessment and training, and he'll talk about that more in the discussion. In his role at IBM, he's also responsible for providing thought leadership, developing innovative products and services, and advising clients on best practices in talent management, including the development and implementation of customized selection systems for all levels of the organization. So join me in welcoming Kevin, please.
Hello, hello. Can you hear me all right?
Yeah.
All right, good deal. Well, yes, first I want to say, I always when I go to SIOP, I always try to go to sessions that have a non-IO speaking, so I always enjoy, you know, Ben's talk when you have someone that's that doesn't have the IO background and training. I always learn so much more. So unfortunately, now you get me. I'm an IO guy. So as Krista mentioned, what I'm going to talk a little bit about today is technology and the role of assessment, and basically how technology has made assessment evolve over the years. And so since we're here in Hawaii, one of my favorite shows of all time, Lost, was filmed here in Hawaii. So for those of you not familiar with the show, you should go get the DVDs and watch it or whatever, it's great. But throughout the show, they time travel. What I'm going to do a little bit throughout my talk is time travel a little bit, so I just want to give you a heads up there. So let's go back to 2000. In 2000, a lot of assessments were still delivered in paper and pencil. More and more, we're moving to assessments delivered via the computer, and then more and more people started to have access to this thing called the internet. People are moving online. But still in that process, then, there still is the proctor, right? There's still this fear of, you know, pushing assessments out to the world. And let's time travel a little bit closer to 2004. We have these big debates at SIOP about unproctored internet testing. As you see this person sitting at their couch at home taking an assessment, some IOs are throwing up their hands saying it's unethical. And as a practitioner like myself, we're saying, well, our clients are demanding it, so it's happening. The train has left the station. And let's fast forward to 2010. I think that's really been when the advent of applicant tracking systems have come up. As a consultant, a lot of the assessments I had created and worked with clients to create were then baked in the application process. So as opposed to getting about maybe 2,000 assessments per year, I'm getting 200,000 assessments per year. People are going straight online to the assessments. It's pushing up early. So to help organizations filter through the thousands and millions of candidates applying for jobs. So it's been a little bit of a paradigm shift when you think about how assessments are developed and deployed. In the past, it was more of a push. Research and science were saying these constructs are important to measure. And then through the research and science that pushes to test distributors that put together items and measure those constructs. Then the test administrator then delivers that to the test taker. And what the cloud represents is the technology that facilitates that. So we're saying these psychological constructs are important to measure, and the technology is merely a medium to deliver these. And it was kind of an afterthought, like, okay, paper and pencil. All right, computers, that's fine. Where we are now, we're being pulled. The test taker is saying, I want to take this on a mobile device. The test taker is saying that I'm used to having interactive games. I'm used to going to these consumer sites, and they know who I am, and they tailor the experience just for me. You need to do that as an employer. And then the test distributors or consulting firms are then scrambling around saying, well, can we deliver assessments on mobile devices? Let's look at some data. And then far behind that is actually the academics and research and science. They don't have access to that data. And so it's a complete paradigm shift. And as you see, technology is all around that, right? So rather than technology just being kind of in the background, it really influences how assessments are understood and interpreted. So thinking about some of the trends that we're seeing, as Kristen mentioned, I'm a psychologist. I signed in to get my CE credits there and get my PhD. And I work for one of the world's biggest, IT firms in their software division, right? So rather than delivering tests and assessments to people, we're delivering software. We're delivering software on a cloud. If you see any IOs out there, they talk about the cloud. IBM requires me to say cloud in every presentation, by the way. But you know, it's how our business is perceived. And I think a lot of IOs can identify with this, especially those in more of the testing assessment areas. Am I a consultant? Am I a psychological consultant? Or am I someone that helps facilitate sell widgets with software companies, right? So it's definitely a shift in thought. And so one of the latest trends is mobile devices. Clients are coming to us demanding that our assessments need to be delivered on mobile devices. Well, one thing I just want to clarify, too, is not all mobile is equal. We kind of talk about mobile as it's one thing. Well, there's Blackberries, there's iPhones, there's tablets, there's phablets, which is an unfortunate name, by the way. And, you know, it's really about the screen size. You know, it's talking about, okay, is it a mobile device or is it a PC? You're talking about screen size, you're talking about operating systems, you're talking about bandwidth, you're talking about a number of different roles. What we've seen is that more minority applicants access assessments via mobile devices, because that's really some of their main methods for accessing the internet. They may not have a computer at home, they may just access the internet through that. The other thing that's pretty clear is that I think while a lot of companies, specifically my clients, and people think that everyone's doing it online, it's really about 5 to 10% of people completing the assessments. Now granted, there's nowhere in the instructions saying, hey, this is available on a mobile device. Once you make that case, then it definitely increases. The other thing that we found is that for, you know, typical Likert scales, personality items, those we don't see any sort of difference. So there's a recent article in the International Journal of Selection Assessment that summarized some of the different SIOP findings. Once again, that was all research based on practitioners and consulting firms, including some of my own research, that were cobbled together and then put in the journal. But we do find differences in cognitive ability tests. So where there's more cognitive load, there's more complexity, there's an opportunity for that to fail. I would say on the inverse of that, though, I think there's a lot more opportunity using the technology within tablets, for instance, to assess things like cognitive ability. So if anyone's familiar with the Wechsler scales, the WAIS scales, they have that delivered on tablets now. So rather than I used to do when you do individualized assessment, I'd have the blocks where you move the blocks together to make shapes. Well, you can do all that on a tablet now, and then you can score it through that as well. So you can manipulate things on a tablet that that you could otherwise was a lot more labor intensive. The next thing that's really emerging, and it's been around for a while, but quite honestly, clients haven't picked up on it as quickly, is simulations or video SJTs. So the left is one from IBM Conexa. Basically, you just have a stimulus, a situation. Rather than having it in text, you just display it in a video, and they ask the best and worst thing to do. A little tweak on that, other one's from Logiserve. You can use technology to kind of slide the scale about how effective are those responses, what's your most likely to do a response. So that's something you wouldn't otherwise get to do. So it's a slight tweak on that. Now, this is another one with IBM Connects we've done with Ministry of Defense, where you can get, there's more and more realistic, high-fidelity type environments that you can create. So that's another one that we've done with a warehouse distributor. And so the more realistic that you can make it, the better. Then my colleague Ben Hawks has done a lot of research to where you definitely don't want some of the animation to look too creepy either. You kind of scare everyone. So, but there's a lot more flexibility when you use animation versus live action. You have to refilm. There's all sorts of issues. And then this other one comes from Shaker. So Shaker does a lot of the virtual job tryout, where you're really mimicking as close as you can. You know, it's essentially a work sample, what they're doing in the job itself. So this is exactly what a teller would go through and complete. So rather than just, you know, look at a video or stimulus or people interacting and say what you're going to do, it's really incorporating the aspects of the job in that simulation. The other area that's emerging is what I like to call edutainment. So it's kind of entertainment and educating about the company. So these are quizzes that people take to learn about the company, but they're not necessarily a selection hurdle that screens people out or selects people in. So this is one we've done with Cabela's, where we did some culture work with them. And if you go onto their career site, you can do a culture quiz about were you born to work here. And so it's really helping facilitate that self-selection out of the process. We did another one with IKEA where you incorporate aspects of their brand. So as you answer these questions, you build your room with a different IKEA furniture in there. And so it's a very kind of interactive, fun type of environment. There's another one for General Mills. I don't know exactly who does it, but I just came across it, where you can choose like which character you are. And so if you're a college graduate and you're looking to work at their corporate office, you know, figure out what particular field you want to work in, you can go through and it gives you some insights. So it's just kind of a fun edutainment one. And then if you want to go insane, you can check this one out as well. So this company developed a live-action SJT. So the production value is actually really good on this. You have this actor here who's extremely creepy and basically walks you around through basically a live SJT with actors in there. And it starts from when you get up in the morning and how you're going to work to this office. And then at different points in time, it says, okay, are you going to do this or this and this? But so this is like white backgrounds. There's some naked guy in a tub at some point. But it's really interesting. But at the end, you get a profile. I know some IO researchers are actually involved in creating this. And you get a profile, but also can pull some of your social media information in as well. But it's a way of promoting their brand. You know, do you want to work here? Frankly, I didn't, but it was pretty interesting. So then the next evolution is this gaming area. So serious games. You know, within IBM, we've done quite a bit of this, mainly around helping people with formulating strategy. Business schools as they're working through logistics. And this is really primarily staying in somewhat of the learning and development space. One of the key elements of gaming is that you get feedback on how you're doing, right? When you enjoy games, you like to get to the next level. You got to see how many stars you get. So it hasn't necessarily been applied in selection yet because you don't necessarily want your applicants to know how they're doing, right? But maybe organizations will be okay with that at some point. But with the gaming, it's really more for you to learn and understand and to keep you engaged and kind of to increase the difficulty level. Now, the one area where gaming is definitely interesting is some of these Silicon Valley firms. So Nacket, for instance, has Wasabi Waiter. And this is a game that I would just play for fun anyways, right? So in this simulation, basically, you're a waiter, but what you need to do is you have to correctly identify people's emotions in the restaurant. So people will have, their faces will change. You have to say, are they angry? Are they sad? Are they upset? Are they curious? Are they melancholy? And you get certain points for correctly identifying that. At the same time, you're trying to multitask by dropping off menus, delivering the food, bussing the table. And the thing that they're measuring throughout this is, and that's what's interesting, and the simulations, if you go back to the kind of video SJTs, it's a stimulus and response. It's one-to-one. In a game, you respond. Based on your response, you go to a different way. So it's a branching technique. With this, you're measuring multiple things at once. You're measuring their ability to adjust to the strategy, their ability to multitask, their ability to read emotion, how they increase complexity. Another firm, Gravitalent, essentially takes like Tetris here, and it's measuring how you adapt to each different stage and change in complexity as you go through there. So it's getting some of that metadata as you're clicking through and you're making a lot of false clicks and things like that. And so that's all this information that's being collected through, you know, you're kind of ambivalent. You don't know that they're tracking all this data. You're just having fun playing a game. So these two examples I like to pull up here too, because there's the other element of job relatedness, right? If you're applying for a waiter role, okay, that one might make a little bit more sense. But if you're playing Tetris, that might be a little bit weird. The other emerging technology I see is this kind of passport approach. So there's at the top, there's some proficiency scores on some skills. And this is coming from a company called Smarterer. Sounds weird saying that, but Smarterer. And basically, you can go through and assess yourself and your proficiency in all of these different skills, whether it's Microsoft Excel or social media. So it's supposed to go into, let's say, IBM Connexion using one of their 1,300 skills tests to pay for. The applicant can go and take it themselves. So much like, for instance, in applying for graduate school or applying for higher education, you take the SAT once, right? And then all the different schools take it. There are some consulting firms out there where you take their one personality test, And then if one of their clients is using it, you may apply to one client in a different industry and apply to another one, and they'll recognize you and say, oh, here's your personality profile. They may score it a little bit differently based on that profile, but it's this process of, you know, once again, rather than the organization pushing out and saying, okay, you take this assessment, it's the applicant coming with the information about themselves. So this trend is emerging. Once again, IBM requires me to say big data in every presentation, but there's obviously quite a few sessions on this. You know, we create 2.5 quintillion bytes of data. That number sounds like something my five-year-old son made up, but the thing that's interesting is just how quickly the amount of data has increased. So much to what Ben's talking about, you know, just the data being collected around us, not just of what we're producing out in, you know, maybe social media world, but as an example with the RFID at our last IBM conference, we did have that. We tracked where people went in different sessions based on their badge. We had RFID. So Big Brother's watching. But you know, we have all this data and being able to mine it, and from an organizational standpoint, businesses are doing this as a key strategic advantage from a consumer. You go to Amazon, they know what you're going to like. More and more companies are leveraging this. They're creating chief data officers and things like that. Well, we definitely are going to apply that to HR. So how do we do that? Well, a lot of that's just through text mining, gathering the data that's out there. So a lot of people have a social media footprint already through Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter, Pinterest. A researcher with an IBM actually is able to take tweets and build your personality profile. So taking 200 different tweets, they're able to mine that data and give you a profile based on, you know, kind of general big five type dimensions. Now, I'm just going to be the first to say we're still doing research to see how accurate that is. But in this case, we go from, let's back up, right? We're going from, hey, you want this job? Take this assessment. Then we go from, I'm an applicant. Here's my assessment results. Here you go. Now the applicant's not doing anything. They're not giving them something. They're not taking something. It's a passive a way of assessing them, and it's happening more and more. Another cool research initiative they looked at, the tweets of people going through the different train lines in London, and they had different Myers-Briggs profiles for all the different lines. And so some researcher, that was the public data that was out there. Taking it a step further, rather than just taking the data that you're presenting, you can go inside your brain, right? We're getting more advanced ways to do fMRI technology. The whole glass brain was previewed at South by Southwest this year. So just, you know, if we want to continue this, let's take it a step further, right? Rather than these paper and pencil tests, we can look inside their brain, try to predict behavior. So it'd be cool if I had like the lost, like the dun-dun, go back. But we're going to go back in time a little bit, real quick. 1942, we're using the Rorschach, the inkblot test. So you're looking at ambiguous stimulus, and you're responding to it, you're talking about it. And then through your words, the clinical psychologist is supposed to go through and identify a personality profile. Maybe something like responding to the world through Facebook or Twitter. And we're taking their information and trying to make some sense out of it. Right? These concepts aren't new, but technology is allowing us to do this in slightly different ways. Let's go back in time even more. It's 1820, phrenology. Looking inside your head to understand what sort of personality profile your behavior is going to do. Well, now we have fMRI technology to look inside your head to do exactly that. So just to leave you with some comfort from the Dharma Initiative within Lost, all of you are being assessed right now. I would say that if any of you tweeted that you're going to the last session in PSYOP, probably rate you as very conscientious, so that's a good thing. Just know that we're tracking your data and you're being assessed every day. So thank you.
Thanks, Kevin. So technically this session does end at 2:50, but I had ahead of time secured that we have the room until 3. So I do want to make sure that we have time if anyone has questions for Kevin or Ben, if you guys don't mind coming up. Yes.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, well, I think the privacy question is really central to what we do, right? I mentioned it briefly, but there's a few questions that we answer, right? Which is that we don't record what you say. The company has no access to your individual data, only aggregate statistics. And we don't count how many times you go to the bathroom, right? Those are important. I mean, basically, if you can answer those three questions, and we also do this on an opt-in basis, and if people don't want to participate, we actually give them a fake badge, right? So that no one knows they're not participating. Even so, we've gotten over 90% participation in every single rollout we've done, and thousands of people. And I think that's because we don't just come into a company and say, here, wear this. Because I wouldn't participate if somebody did that. It takes about 4 weeks to roll it out. You introduce the technology, you explain what we do, we give people consent forms which show the actual database tables of what we collect. Again, we don't, people get access to their own data and they can delete their own data if they want. That doesn't really happen, but we give people those options. And I think that that's really critical for this technology moving forward, because legally in the US, I could force employees to wear these sensors. I could look at their individual data, and there's nothing you could do about it. We think that's bad, and we think that if that continues, that eventually this sort of work will be legislated out of existence. But we can get, you've seen some of the benefits we can get. And I think that in order for this industry to continue to grow, we're going to need to, at first, just adopt those sort of that approach to data, but at the same time also push for legislation. And we've been doing that as well. One of my co-founders, Sandy Pentland, co-authored with the World Economic Forum this thing called the New Deal on Data, which essentially just lays out what I just talked about in terms of individual ownership, opt-in, aggregate, all those things. So I think those are all going to be necessary and are frankly very important and very important questions. Quick, yeah, sure. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, you could accept that you can opt in, or you could opt out and wear a badge, and no one would know except you. So we try to take as much social pressure out of the situation as we can. But I think, I mean, what I can tell you is that if we just went in there and first answer those three questions about recording things, about your boss looking at data, we'd probably get 75% buy-in at that time. The point is we make this into your ID badge. I mean, in the future, this is just going to be your ID badge. And I think then the questions get even more important, because then you're going to have this anyway. And what guarantees can you give people about those things? I don't know if that answered your question, but hopefully at least a little bit. Another one?
Go ahead.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Sure. Yeah, well, there's a lot there. I don't want to get too much into the algorithms, but essentially the way you think about it is this. If we're in a conversation and I'm talking, you're probably not talking. And what that means is that in a conversation, in order to detect that we're talking to each other, yeah, proximity is important, but then I sort of need your speaking signals to line up, right? I need those things so that, if exactly when I'm talking, you're not talking, the probability that would occur due to chance is essentially zero. Once you get beyond 30 seconds, to your point, we can't, if you just lean over to someone and say, hi, and then you go back, I can't detect that. But I would argue that's not, while it would be nice to detect that, the more important things are, you talk a little bit. We talk for 20, 30 seconds. We talk for a couple minutes. I mean, that's what we're picking up on.
Over here.
Sure. Well, I completely agree. Well, one thing I would say, and a reason we like to separate what we do from the whole quantified self area, which probably a lot of you are familiar with, what's interesting about, for example, Fitbit and those sort of things, the average usage time of those platforms is 4 weeks because people stop using them. What you see is you see a graph of your own behavior, You see you see that you're improving, and then you stop using it. Because it's just a graph, it's just data. What we do, we provide feedback to individuals. And part of that is to keep them participating, but part of it is also to bring a lot of value to them and bring that reciprocity in. So a big area for us right now is retail, and we're deploying our dashboards in retail. In retail, a lot of people are paid based on commission. What I can do is I can tell you, what does the best salesperson do? How do they talk to customers? Where do they spend time? And what that means is, sure, I give individuals a dashboard where they could log in and see all these things, but no one does that. Instead, what we do is I send them one MMS a day or a week as one graph. And it says, here's what you do, here's what the top performers do, here's one way to change that behavior. For example, it'll be something like you spend 10% of your time talking to customers, the top people spend 15% of their time talking to customers. In order to do that, in order to raise that, spend 20 minutes of your day at the front of the store. That's it. But I think that being very simple, being very actionable with that sort of feedback is critical for not just ensuring participation, but also for getting the full value of what we can do with this data. Because sure, there's all this top-down stuff where we can get really big results, but if you can also enable this rapid change at the bottom, I mean, think how hard it would be for me to retrain everybody to spend time in different places if I'm trying to implement a new training procedure versus I can just push something to your phone and say, you know, do this. And if it works, you get paid more, and really everybody wins.
Do you want to comment?
Oh, sorry. It's easier for them to find what they're looking for because they'll modify the site based on their previous pattern. That may seem kind of creepy to people, but a lot of people like that, right? And so it's just easier access to the information they want to get. I would say from an assessment standpoint, we'd probably have to think about how we leverage that. That's going to be a benefit to them, not just for the company. So is it more about their fit, information we could give them for their ongoing learning and development, rather than just a pure benefit to the organization? Now, people also recognize, too, that the reason companies are doing that from a consumer standpoint is so that they'll buy more stuff. So, and I think people just become more open and accepting. I would say even just 5 years ago, like, ooh, they're collecting that information. Now people are like, all right, fine. That's how it is. You know, that's how the world is. So, but the more and the more you can try to sell the benefit to the individual, and I think the better.
We have time for one more question.
Yeah, so for, right now, most of the assessments that I'm working on is mainly just an individual completing different exercises or completing responses and not necessarily, you know, doing more of the kind of social collaboration and gaming. That definitely is another area that is emerging around the social collaboration. But the one thing thinking about mobile is that when you're trying to work with a lot of different variables, it's hard to capture that in a screen the size of an iPhone, right? If you're getting input from multiple people, all these different. And so there's some cool, and the thing I failed to mention is in some of the gaming, you see some of the same applications in like online assessment centers. And for the most part, a tablet, you're thinking mobile, a tablet, that's fine. You can do that there. But for the more smaller screen devices, the more information you're piping in there, it becomes an issue. You deal with people's bandwidth and stuff like that. But I would say that would definitely be a trend because that's how people communicate now. You know, they're texting each other, right? They're filling out email, mobile devices. So I could definitely see that happening more as people are trying to more replicate what the actual job looks like.
All right. Well, I think we're out of time, but Kevin and Ben, I'm sure, are happy to hang around and answer any additional questions you might have. So thanks again for coming, and I think it's been a great fly-off.